Okay, good morning, everyone. This morning is a continuation of our Sunday Locks and Learn program, which ordinarily Rabbi Shiffman delivers this year on Pirkei Avos. And this morning we have the honor of our guest, Professor Aaron Kohler. All of these Torah opportunities that we have are sponsored by Jake and Karen Abelevitz in memory of Jake's parents. Yeah, please. In memory of Jake's parents, Eliyahu ben Abba and Leah bas Avram, as well as Karen's brother, Yoshua ben Shimon. And we'll throw in also refuah shleima for all those who need it. I just want to take a moment to note that so many of these Torah opportunities are sponsored by Jake and Karen, Le'iloi Nishmas, and is zechus for all concerned. And without their generosity and without their leadership and without their commitment, we would be, I don't mean financially poorer, but we would be poorer spiritually as a community. And so it is with a great sense of gratitude and hakara satov. I kidded with Jake a few weeks ago that he could open up a soup kitchen because doing a Locks and Learn on Sunday mornings, and then on Thursday evenings we're having a dinner, and then on Wednesdays we have lunch. So, you know, you could open up a soup kitchen if pharmacological business doesn't work out, you know. But we are in such a state of a gratitude, hakara satov. We can't say it enough or often enough, because the zchuyos of our Talmud Torah are really have an infinite schar to them. So, on behalf of a grateful congregation and on behalf of everyone who's here today, we thank you, Jake and Karen, and we wish you much continued success and continued opportunities for you to be mezaka the tzibur in such purposeful and meaningful ways. Thank you very much. Our guest this morning, Dr. Aaron Kohler, is an assistant professor of Bible at Yeshiva College. He received his doctorate in Bible and Semitics from YU's Revel School of Jewish Studies after doing coursework at the University of Pennsylvania and YU, where he focused on Semitic and other Near Eastern languages and Iron Age history, while also studying linguistics, Bible, Levantine archaeology, and Second Temple period history. He also has a strong interest in contemporary ethical thought. He's written papers about Aramaic dialects and the Dead Sea Scrolls, and also teaches classes on Bible interpretation and history at the Drisha Institute. Dr. Kohler's topic this morning is Bar Kokhba, through the lens of archaeology and the eyes of Chazal. Aaron Kohler.
Morning. It's an honor to be here. It's a special pleasure to be here because I haven't been in this building in about 25, 30 years, but used to come pretty frequently to visit friends in the neighborhood, to visit for a lot of bar mitzvahs in this room. I grew up in Flatbush. I guess the other end of Flatbush. So haven't been back in a while, but it's a real treat to be here. Thank you for your hospitality. Thank you for the invitation. Thank you, Rabbi Tokayer, for the introduction. I would like to spend our time this morning talking about how Chazal thought about Bar Kokhba. In order to do that, we need to spend a bit of time talking about what we know about Bar Kokhba. Let me ask you a simple question to start. What was Bar Kokhba's real name?
Shimon Bar Kosiba.
Shimon Bar Kosiba, wonderful. Bar Kokhba is not something... That's my first grade teacher. So. I actually knew that in first grade, but most people don't. The fact that we call him Bar Kokhba at all is actually entirely modern. No Jew called him Bar Kokhba until about the 19th century. Jews didn't know that his name was Bar Kokhba, because as we just heard, his name was not actually Bar Kokhba. In Chazal, in rabbinic literature, as we'll see, his name is always Ben Kozba, which may or may not be a play on his name. The name Bar Kokhba is preserved only in early Christian literature. And it was only in the Renaissance that a couple of Jewish scholars realized that there were texts about a guy named Ben Kozba in Chazal, and texts about a guy named Bar Kokhba, or Bar Kokhbeis, in Christian literature, and that these are actually the same person. I mentioned that at the beginning to give an indication of how little is actually known about this person. How do we now know his name? Because in the middle of the 20th century, first some Bedouin and then archaeologists discovered a bunch of documents with his name on them, because they were actually letters from Bar Kokhba to members of his administration. There are also some contracts that mention his name, but for the first time, his name and the person emerged from legend into the light of more or less history. You have at the top of the page a copy of just his name, Mishimon ben Kosba. What the vowel is under the samach is a little bit unclear, but it doesn't matter to us. Shimon ben Kosba, Kaf Vav Samach Bet Hey in this letter. His own name is spelled four different ways in his letters because he's clearly not writing them. We have 15 letters from Bar Kokhba, all in 15 different handwritings. So he's clearly dictating to someone, and different people write his name in different ways. So with a Vav, without a Vav, with a Hey at the end, with an Aleph at the end, it clearly doesn't matter, but his name is Shimon ben Kosba. With those discoveries, and the discoveries were very exciting. If some of you might recall, the discoveries were actually made, the crucial discoveries were made by Yigael Yadin in 1916-61. Yadin was already famous because he was the chief of staff of the army in the 1948 War of Independence. He was already a celebrity as a war hero. I know going through some of the YU archives, he had come to visit YU in the mid-50s. It was front page of a student newspaper. They had an interview with him as a war hero. He's a war hero who had then gone on to Oxford to do his doctorate in Bible and archaeology, and then had come back to Israel and was making his name as an archaeologist. In 1961, he was, I'm not going to get into all the details, although it's quite fascinating, he was a junior archaeologist on a team that was assigned four different areas in the Judean desert to go look for documents. He got the worst assignment, in an area called Nachal Chever, which he and his team had to rappel down a sheer cliff face in order to get to a cave that was about halfway down. The assumption was that there wasn't going to be anything there, because if they had to rappel down, how could anything have gotten there? But when they got in, they actually found relatively quickly a huge cache of artifacts, including documents, from Bar Kokhba's time. Some of those we'll touch on later as well, but the documents were the things that were most immediately exciting, because you had his name, you had a correspondence from Bar Kokhba. Bar Kokhba himself, from what we can piece together, was not in these caves. He was elsewhere. Chazal tell us that he was in Beitar, which was his stronghold and the last place where he managed to hold out against the Romans. We'll come back to the basic story in a second. But one of his generals, Yonatan Bar Bayan, was apparently in this cave, and all the letters that Bar Kokhba had sent to Yonatan were together in this cave. Now, what does it tell us about the end of the story if we find these letters in the cave? What happened to Yonatan? Yeah, he apparently didn't make it out of the cave. Had he made it out, he presumably would have taken them with him. It wasn't hard for the Romans to sort of track down these people and make sure that they met their end there. On top of the cliff, there are remains of a very small Roman camp. And that's all the Romans had to do. They just had to sit there. If the Jews leave, they can shoot them. If they don't leave, then they're dead eventually. It seems that they actually did die in the cave, although it's hard to be 100% sure that this is linked. There was also a bag of skulls in the cave. A bag of skulls is really a fascinating find. It's obviously a chilling find, but it's also fascinating, because what does a bag of skulls tell you? Somebody came back afterwards and collected skulls and put them in a bag. So this is if you want to see sort of gruesome pictures of it, you could probably just Google and find it. But Yigael Yadin's daughter is a film producer, and on her website, Yadin Productions, she has all the pictures from his excavations. So you can find all of these pictures that are otherwise in books, you can find them online, including these really gruesome pictures of a bag, a woven bag, full of skulls found in the same cave. What's the basic story? Bar Kokhba is a rebel. Right? He's rebelling against Rome. He's rebelling against Rome about 60-something years after Churban HaBayit. After the second Beit HaMikdash is destroyed, it's been about two generations, and Bar Kokhba is a rebel. Where does he come from? We have no idea. We don't know anything about the person. Now that we know his name, that seems like a major accomplishment for historians. We actually know the person's real name. We still know very little about him as a person. We don't know where he came from. We don't know how he became the rebel leader. We don't know if he was just a charismatic leader, if he was wealthy, if he had been in some sort of position of power before the 130s. We know nothing about the backstory to Bar Kokhba himself. But somehow, between the years 132 and 135 or 6, he led a revolution against the Romans. It's very clear, as we'll see very soon, that the rebellion had religious overtones, and that was a big part of the identity of the rebellion, was that he was fighting for religious causes. He wanted to retake Yerushalayim from the Romans. Rebuilding the Beit HaMikdash was the end game here. That was the goal. The Beit HaMikdash had, of course, been destroyed for two generations. It was Bar Kokhba himself, almost certainly, assuming he was not 75 years old, had never seen the Beit HaMikdash. But that was the goal that they had in mind. The spark that set off the rebellion is almost certainly the plan of Hadrian, who had recently toured in the area, to rebuild Jerusalem as a great Roman city. Hadrian probably thought that this was actually a good idea. In other words, that look, Jerusalem had been one of the great cities in the Roman Empire when Herod had rebuilt it. Herod's Beit HaMikdash lasted less than 70 years. So a real shame that this tremendously impressive building, said to be one of the most impressive structures in the Roman Empire, had been destroyed for Jewish folly. They had rebelled. I'm speaking for Hadrian now. They had rebelled. The temple had to be destroyed. And what a shame that this great city is now lying in half in ruins. So Hadrian tours the region in 130, 131 and says, look, this is a great city. I'm going to rebuild it. I'm going to bestow all my imperial gifts on the city. We'll rebuild it. We'll build a great temple to Jupiter in the city. And it'll be, again, a great city in the Roman Empire. He presumably thought that was a good thing to do that the citizens would appreciate. But of course, the Jews were never cooperative citizens, because the Jews said, this is our city. It's nice that you want it to be a great Roman city. We have no interest in it being a great Roman city. We want it to be either a great Jewish city or a poor Jewish city, but not a great Roman city. And Hadrian's plan to build a temple to Jupiter, maybe on Har HaBayit, maybe elsewhere in the city, but anywhere in the city of Yerushalayim, was clearly the spark that gave rise to this rebellion. So Bar Kokhba, who again, we don't know anything about his backstory, Bar Kokhba is now in the planning stages, and we know from a number of sources, as well as archaeology, that he spent at least a year planning the rebellion. The archaeology, which I've just mentioned, Al Regel Achat, and I'm not going to spend time on right now, is that there are hundreds of underground tunnel complexes that were prepared for the rebellion. That Bar Kokhba and his supporters had dug out hundreds, mostly in the Shvela and the area south of Yerushalayim, hundreds of underground tunnel complexes where they could retreat to, hide out in, pop up, so to speak, attack a Roman garrison here or a bunch of Roman soldiers there, and then get back into their place of refuge because they knew that they could not take on the Roman Empire in an open field battle. That's a suicidal mission. And their goal was to engage in this sort of guerrilla warfare, but it takes preparation. Right? It takes preparation. So they spent a year or so preparing. And then as they started, they actually were more successful than anyone could have possibly imagined. And the Romans could not easily quash the rebellion. I said already it took from 132 to 135 or 6. That in and of itself is an amazing fact. That it took the Romans three and a half years to defeat the Jews is astounding. And again, we're not going to spend much time on on the vicissitudes of the war itself, but I'll just mention that the Romans, about halfway through, had to bring in, Hadrian had to bring in his best generals, including, we're told by the best source that we have, Julius Severus, who was already an experienced general who had been recently posted as the governor of Britain. Hadrian, very famously, had brought peace to Britain, right? Hadrian's Wall, I don't know if anyone's ever visited it, but Hadrian's Wall splits Britain. That was the outer limits of the Roman Empire in Hadrian's time. And Hadrian had to send and bring Julius Severus, who was posted off in literally the farthest northwest corner of the Roman Empire, because he was the best general that Hadrian had, to quash this rebellion. So it took a long time. It took massive amounts of effort on the Roman side. And we'll come back to a little bit of detail of that soon. But the rebellion was really much more successful than anyone could have imagined. And yet, I have to say, and this is going to be an important point to emphasize, there was no way it was going to succeed. No rational person at any point could have possibly thought that Bar Kokhba could be successful here. It's just not possible to defeat the Roman Empire if the Roman Empire is willing to bring its resources to bear on this war. There's only two possible things that Bar Kokhba could have hoped. He could have hoped, this would have been a bad idea, but he could have hoped that the Romans would not bring their resources to bear. In other words, the Romans would simply say, it's not worth the fight. If he looked at a map, he would have known that was an impossible hope, because Judea, the province that he's fighting for, is surrounded by other Roman provinces, and there's no way the Romans are going to give up on a province in the middle of their territory. But he could have hoped that. The other hope, which is almost certainly what he was hoping, was that God would intervene. That also turned out not to work out as well as he would have hoped. But that brings us back to the religious side of things. So what we're going to see this morning is a bit of the mundane side of things, a bit of the workings of the revolution, a bit of what we know of what happened, and a focus on who and what was thinking religiously about this war. So just to get us into it, I want to look at one quick letter you have on this first page. The letter in and of itself is not doesn't fundamentally change anything historically. It doesn't tell us any great insight into the rebellion, but it does give us a taste of the interchanges of the interactions between Bar Kokhba and his men as the war is drawing to a close. How do I know it says the war is drawing to a close? So remember, this is found in the cave where Yonatan is hiding out. Why is Yonatan hiding out in the cave? Yeah, clearly he sees that things are going badly. Right now, of course, he doesn't go to a cave thinking, okay, this is the end, I might as well die in a cave. He goes to a cave thinking, okay, the Romans are winning right now, let me escape to a cave, hopefully they'll go away, and I'll be able to get out of here. But that does imply that whatever he's carrying with him are the last correspondences that he has, not our entire archive from the last 4 years of military action. So this one letter that we'll look at quickly starts, Mishimon Bar Kokhba. Mishimon Bar Kokhba. So you know that's not the same letter that you have a picture of at the top. Mishimon Bar Kokhba la Anshe Ein Gedi. La Masabala ula Yonatan Bar Bayan. Shalom. So these two people, Masabala, Yonatan, not for this morning, but we actually know a decent amount about these people. They were clearly in charge of Bar Kokhba's garrison in Ein Gedi. Ein Gedi was actually, you might think of Ein Gedi in all sorts of ways. Kibbutz Ein Gedi, certainly. So it was an important, we'll see soon. Agriculturally, it was actually important. But something that we might not consider, at least intuitively, was an important port for Bar Kokhba. It was the only water that he had, was the Dead Sea. And they actually had ships traversing the Dead Sea. Obviously, you can't get to too many places in the Dead Sea, but it connects them to the other side of the Dead Sea. In other words, to the area that's now Jordan. And he has support there as well as resources there. So Ein Gedi turns out to be an important port for him. So after saying shalom, though, which sounds like a nice greeting, B'tov aten yoshvin, ochlin v'shotim minichsei Beit Yisrael, v'lo do'agin l'achechen l'chol davar. You're sitting there eating, drinking, out of the property of the of Beit Yisrael, you're not worrying about your brothers at all. In other words, En Gedi, at least Bar Kokhba thinks that En Gedi, they're just enjoying, they're relaxing. En Gedi's a wonderful place to be, right? Sitting in the spa, you're putting mud on, and you're not worrying about the fact that your brothers are apparently in bad circumstances, right? What's happening to your brothers? We can only infer. What's happening to their brothers? Presumably, they're getting beaten militarily. Letters are always incredibly interesting for historians, because they're much more real than anything literary. Right? This is real life. This is someone in real time writing to someone. They're also much more frustrating, because they always presuppose some background that we never have. And what did they say beforehand? What's going on? What's happening in Bar Kokhba's place? We don't even know where he's writing from. What's happening in Gedi? Who brought the letter here? What was the last letter from in the other direction? There's always more that we don't know about letters. V'tasfinot shepakdun aleichem lo alten l'chol davar. And as for the boats, which they've apparently inspected at your place, you haven't done anything. Again, apparently there's some boats that they're supposed to be doing with. We don't know exactly, but he's very mad at them. Aval haveyadin shedvarchem imi. Just know that your case is with me. Which sounds very ominous. Val perot sheetzlachem shetizaru behem. Which ta'amru b'meira misfina sheesh etzlachem b'machoz shetetzur et achechem b'machoz. And then the second column is quite broken. So this fruit that's with you, make sure to handle them carefully. Pack them up. Something about a boat. And then machoz of the port, something about the port, but we don't know exactly what the command is here. But this is Bar Kokhba, again, in the last few months of his rebellion, clearly things are already going bad, even in writing to his generals, where he has practical things to say, something about fixing boats, something about fruits. He can't resist also just being mad. He's actually angry, and, you know, it's hard to say that this is pure frustration bubbling over, but it's also hard to imagine that that's not part of it. That he knows he's presiding now over a losing rebellion, and when he's writing to his generals, who have, there's an actual content that he needs to convey to them, but he also is just upset at the way things are going. The last thing before we see anything on Chazal's side, if you flip to page 2, you have a few coins, two coins of Bar Kokhba's rebellion. Of course, there are hundreds of Bar Kokhba coins that have been discovered. And there's, again, a lot to say about the coins that we won't talk about today, but this morning I just want to look at two coins to see a couple of aspects of them. So the coin on the left, just front and back of the same coin, you'll note immediately that it's not entirely easy to read the writing on these coins. Why is it not entirely easy to read the writing on these coins? Yeah, this is old Hebrew script. Old Hebrew script. So you might know from the Gemara, you might know from archaeology, when did they stop using old Hebrew script? What the Gemara calls Ketav Ivri. I don't know. The time of Ezra. That's what the Gemara. The Gemara says it was the time of Ezra, which is archaeologically about right as well. Middle of the Persian period. What we see archaeologically is that they stop using the old Hebrew script, the native Hebrew script, and they switch over to what the Gemara calls Ketav Ashuri, what modern scholars call Aramaic script, because it was being used by everyone to write Aramaic. But here's Bar Kokhba. Think about the time of Ezra. We're now about 600 years later, writing in his coins in Ketav Ivri. Why is he writing Ketav Ivri? It's actually amazing that they can write in Ketav Ivri, that anyone knows the script 600 years after they stopped using it. But why are they writing in Ketav Ivri?
Because it will be intercepted by the Romans.
Well, these are coins, so there's no secrets here. That's a...
coins are usually symbolizing ideal. There's beliefs or messages that you're trying to convey. So by using this Paleo-Hebrew, we kind of go back to this older story, kind of where established this is.
Wonderful. Wonderful. So the whole point of the rebellion is autonomy and independence. Right? So symbolically, to stamp the coins in the native Hebrew script rather than the cosmopolitan Aramaic script is exactly a symbol of what he wants to accomplish. To reclaim independence. Who's the last group of people who were able to successfully set up an independent Jewish state?
The Maccabees.
Exactly, the Maccabees, the Hashmonaim. Their coins are also in Ketav Ivri. Their coins also use the old Hebrew script. And they, we should point out, are the only independent Jewish state since the destruction of Bayit Rishon. Since the destruction of Bayit Rishon, you had the Babylonians, you had the Persians, you had the Seleucids, you had the Ptolemies, you had all sorts of people in charge. The only time that there was independence in Yerushalayim in Judea were the Hashmoneim, and they also used this same symbolism of old Hebrew script. But the writing itself is also, the content is also interesting. So the coin on the left says Shin Mem Ayin on one side, which is presumably short for Shimon. And another side says Elazar HaKohen. Who is this Elazar HaKohen? No, we don't know. We don't know who Elazar HaKohen is. There is a person, Elazar HaModai, Rabbi Elazar HaModai, who shows up in some of the stories that we will not be able to see this morning in the Gemara about Bar Kokhba. It's conceivable that he is a Kohen. We don't know that he's a Kohen. It's conceivable that he is. Modi'in, of course, is a place of the Hashmoneim. So Modai means from Modi'in. Maybe he is a Kohen. But we don't know for a fact that it's the same person.
Maybe this is a Maccabean coin.
Well, it says Shimon on it.
No, the
other side says Shimon Mayan, the Shimon. And it's also found in groups. It's also found in Ked. Most of these coins are not found isolated. So they're found in groups of coins. You find 20 coins at the same time. And again, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but they tend to be collections of Roman coins from Hadrian, maybe Trajan, and some Bar Kokhba coins. So it's clearly coins that someone had together that they hid, figuring they'd come back for it, and of course never came back for it. So it's obviously conceivable that someone had one old coin in their bag, but we have a few dozen of these, all from Bar Kokhba's time. The important point for right now is just that Elazar HaKohen clearly brings something to Bar Kokhba's cause that's valuable to Bar Kokhba. What does he bring? Some connection to the Beit HaMikdash and to religious authority, right? He's the Kohen. What's the picture on that side of the coin? Yeah, apparently a Kadosh Shemen or Pacha Shemen, connection to the Beit HaMikdash. There's more to say, but let's look at the other side, The other coin is even more blatantly temple-oriented, right? Because on one side, it actually has a picture of the Beit HaMikdash, which is, we should point out, the only picture we have of the Beit HaMikdash from within a century of the Beit HaMikdash's own time. So for those art historians who try to reconstruct what Herod's Beit HaMikdash looked like, this is very valuable evidence. You see that it has four columns, for example. Shlomo's Beit HaMikdash, we know from Tanakh, has two, right, called Yachin and Boaz. Herod's Beit HaMikdash apparently has four columns on the facade. It says Shimon around the Beit HaMikdash. And on the other side, what's the picture in the middle? Anyone see what that is? So the lulav and etrog. You see the etrog right next to it? The lulav sticking up with one hadas and one arava. One hadas and one arava. You might recall that there's a machloket in the Mishnah as to how many hadasim and aravot are needed. One of the views is that you need one of each. Anyone remember whose view that is? It's actually important for this. This is not trivia. The Rabbi Akiva. Why is that important? Because Chazal are going to tell us that Rabbi Akiva backed Bar Kokhba. So that would really be an interesting connect the dots game here. If Bar Kokhba's coin has a picture of the lulav and etrog that reflects Rabbi Akiva's halachic view, and Rabbi Akiva is, in turn, the religious authority behind, or at least in part behind, Bar Kokhba's rebellion. Around the lulav and etrog says L'cherut Yerushalayim. Now, L'cherut Yerushalayim is apparently aspirational. It's not marking the fact that they liberated Yerushalayim. It's, this is our goal. We want to liberate Yerushalayim. We can't get into it this morning, but it seems pretty clear that even if Bar Kokhba had, in theory, the power to enter Yerushalayim, because he had defeated the Romans who were in charge of Yerushalayim, he never established Yerushalayim in any sense as a Jewish stronghold. There are actually almost no Bar Kokhba coins found in Yerushalayim, and there was no construction. It was clearly not something that he managed to actually accomplish, retaking and rebuilding Yerushalayim, but L'cherut Yerushalayim, meaning this is our goal. Now, sorry.
Perhaps the lulav and etrog is also back to the Maccabees for a second, that they had a great celebration after the liberation with lulav
right.
Walking through the streets. So maybe this is aspirational going back to that moment.
Wonderful. So yeah, the lulav and etrog, it's actually on the back, the last page here. I'll say it now because we're not going to have time, I think, to get back to this. But we also have one of the letters from Bar Kokhba. Is actually a request for lulavim and etrogim. I'll leave this for you to look at. But I think it's beyond possible, it's beyond coincidence that his coins have lulav and etrog, and the letter that we have actually asks for lulavim and etrogim. And it's clearly true that he needs this for Sukkot, but it also cannot possibly be an accident that we don't have letters asking for matzah or asking for shofarot. Lulav and etrog seems to be, yes, a mitzvah for Sukkot, but also symbolic. And if we had more time, or maybe for a different topic, we could think about what that symbolism of lulav and etrog is. It's probably part of the meaning of it on Sukkot as well. Certainly for the Chashmonaim, it played a role of victory. Midrashim talk about this as waving lulav and etrog is victory after leaving Yom Hadin. The Chashmonaim do it. Bar Kokhba wants to do it. Lulav has a large symbolism as a symbol of victory and a claim. Perhaps. I just said we're not going to spend our time on it, so I'm not going to add more to it. But yeah, I think that's certainly part of it. All right. So having seen all that, so let's talk about the religious part of it. So here's the let's start with one text. Back to page 2. You have a short passage from the Bavli, and I don't usually call the Gemara the Bavli, but it's important to say the Bavli here because this is from Bavel. It's from at least put it in its final form, 400, 450 years later, 500 miles away from Bar Kokhba. And I emphasize that because, as we'll see in a second, the emotional distance from Bar Kokhba is actually striking. So what does the Gemara say about Bar Kokhba? Bar Kozi ba malach tartein shni nupalga. I can't refrain from calling him Bar Kokhba, even though it's not what the source says. Bar Kozba ruled for 2.5 years. Amar luhula rabbanan, ana mashiach. So he rules for 2.5 years, and then he comes to the rabbis and says, I'm the Mashiach. Amru lei. The Mashiach k'tiv d'morach v'da'ein. Really? Well, let's see. About the Mashiach, it says that he can judge through smelling, which is presumably a reference to Yeshayahu Yud-Aleph. Nech zianan imorach v'da'ein. Let's see. Can you judge through smelling? It's a pretty simple test. I actually have no idea exactly what that means, but presumably it's a simple test. So they check it out. Kivan d'chaziyu d'la morach v'da'ein. Since they saw that he cannot judge through smelling, katluhu, they killed him. Who killed him? The rabbis. In other words, according to this passage, Bar Kokhba ruled. It's unclear who he ruled over, how he got to rule, no background here. He ruled for 2.5 years, but he ran into trouble when he claimed to be a Mashiach. When he claimed to be a Mashiach, who stepped in? The rabbis. The rabbi said, you want to claim into the messianic throne? Let's see. And when they found out that he was a false messiah, they killed him. So this is what I mean by the emotional distance, right? They simply, literally, turn on Bar Kokhba. Bar Kokhba was a false Mashiach, so we got rid of him. Let's think for a second about why that needs emotional distance. If you had lived under Bar Kokhba, if you lived through Bar Kokhba, what are the hopes that Bar Kokhba brings?
Israel,
independence, autonomy, Beit HaMikdash, right? It's not just political.
Yeah.
It's political and religious. Those are not different. Those are connected, right? It's religious, political, autonomy. That's what he's bringing to the table. As his rebellion succeeds for a few years, 2.5 years is actually not a bad... There's some memory here of the approximately right length of time. As the rebellion succeeds, and he beats the Romans here, and he doesn't lose there, and he's able to take some territory, what are people's feelings about this? Yeah, you imagine a snowball effect, right? Whatever support he had at the beginning, we have no idea how much support he had at the beginning. Whatever support he has at the beginning increases and increases as Jews say, wait a second, this seemed like a ridiculous idea 2 years ago, right? But maybe it's true that God's stepping in here. Maybe that Hashgacha, maybe that divine help is actually at play here. It's the only way to explain why the Romans are not yet quashed this rebel leader in Judea, and they're still fighting. So if God's actually fighting on our side, we should probably get involved. And presumably more and more people, which of course, for the Romans, becomes more and more of a problem. We won't talk about the Roman strategy now, but it was not a bad strategy. It just turns out to not have worked in this case. And then, of course, after three and a half years, it's crushed. And the Romans bring in at least two full legions, many auxiliary troops, tens of thousands of soldiers. And as I said at the beginning, it was an impossible mission without supernatural aid. It was an impossible mission to begin with. And in fact, the Romans crushed the revolt. So now, thinking religiously, what's the impact of that? It's actually hard to get over, right? I mean, if people have, for the last year or two, been thinking, oh, God's on our side, this is actually a potential messianic figure. We'll see that, we'll come back to that in a second. Then it's hard to get over this tremendous disappointment, right? You, I'm sure, have all seen groups of people who had grand religious hopes for a restoration or redemption that were, on a mundane level at least, crushed. I mean, it's clear to any outside observer that this did not work out. Groups don't tend to simply sit back and say, ah, I guess we were wrong. Right? It turns out we thought maybe this person was a messianic figure. Turns out maybe we thought that this leader was really appointed by God. But I guess we were wrong. I guess we judged wrongly, and we're just going to go on with our life as it was 5 years ago before we had these hopes. That seems to be a psychologically very difficult transition to make. So it's entirely unrealistic that anyone who lived under this time would have simply said, well, you know, we thought Bar Kokhba might have been Mashiach, but I guess not. Add to that the fact that according to the one historical source that we have, which is presumably exaggerated, says that more than 500,000 Jews were killed in the war. I have no doubt that that's a gross exaggeration, but tremendous casualties. That's not to mention the famine and plagues that inevitably follow upon wars. That's not to mention the gzerot, the terrible decrees of Hadrian after the fact, which we know from Chazal against learning Torah. Number of the Asara Harugei Malchut were killed after Bar Kokhba's revolt, when the Romans were entirely furious at the Jews for just wasting their last 3 years with a stupid and futile rebellion. So anyone who lived under this time is not going to simply sit back and say, oh well, it was not a bad idea, but I guess it was wrong. This claim that we find in the Gemara 400 years later, that Bar Kokhba claimed to be Mashiach, but we got rid of him, is entirely unrealistic for anyone who had anything to do with the time of Bar Kokhba itself. And add one last fact, and this will turn to page 3. Here's page 3. One last fact. Tani Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, Akiva Rabbi Haya Doresh, Darach Kochav Miyakov, Darach Kozba Miyakov. Rabbi Akiva Karavachame Bar Kozba Hava Amar, Dein Hu Malka Meshicha. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, Shimon Bar Yochai, taught that my teacher Akiva applied the pasuk from Bilam, a star shall step forth from Yaakov, to Bar Kokhba. That a star, that's Bar Kozba. And then the Gemara, this is from Eicha Rabbah, that has a parallel in the Yerushalmi, that when Rabbi Akiva would see Bar Kozba, he would say, Dein hu Malka Meshicha. This is the Messianic King, the King Messiah. So put that all together, and it's inconceivable that any Jew sitting in 150 CE in Eretz Yisrael is simply going to sort of shrug about Bar Kokhba and say, you know, turns out it was a mistake. Or it's a good thing he died because he was a false Messiah. That is as far from what the mindset of the Jews must have been as possible. What would the mindset have been? Oh, what words come to mind? What's their experience? As they have Rabbi Akiva telling him that this is the Mashiach. You have Elazar HaKohen, whoever this must have been, saying this is a rebellion that has connection to Beit HaMikdash. It has some sort of religious backing to it. You have initial successes, which in fact lead to more people saying, yes, God must be on the side of Bar Kokhba. And then you have a catastrophe that in demographic number terms is far worse than Churban HaBayit. Not only in terms of the number of people killed, which it's worse in that metric, but also in the fact that after Churban HaBayit, Jews still lived in Yerushalayim. Jews still lived in Yehuda. After Bar Kokhba, Hadrian bans Jews from Yerushalayim. Says now, You wanted to keep Yerushalayim as a Jewish city? No more Jews in Yerushalayim. He might have even banned Jews from the area around Yerushalayim. It's a little bit unclear. But when you think about Chazal, and you think about the Tanaim, and you realize that they're all up in the Galil, in Tzipori, Tzipori, Tveria, Kesaria, and so on, that's because after Bar Kokhba, no one's allowed in Yerushalayim anymore. So the effect of Bar Kokhba's revolt was not just a return to 130. You know, while we tried, it was bad, oh well, it didn't work. It's a greater catastrophe than you could have imagined even 70 years earlier. The Jews are in much worse state, demographically, militarily, economically, and religiously, and that's what I want to focus on, than they were in 130. So I think it's actually not at all possible that the rabbis killed Bar Kokhba.
No, I'm saying from the standpoint they were afraid what would happen if, in fact, the rebellion did continue, what would happen to the Jews in Palestine because the Romans were going to crush anything that the Jews did because what happened
during
the 30 years earlier.
The Romans did crush the rebellion.
Exactly. That's right. It was a negative response to
Bar Kokhba. See, here's the key point. From Eretz Yisrael, we don't see a negative response to Bar Kokhba. Let's see a little bit more in this passage from the Midrash. Midrash says, Ma'ya oseh ben Kozba. Why was Bar Kokhba so impressive? Hayam a kabel of nei blistra be'achar me'akuvotav, v'zorkan v'horeg me'en kama nefashot, v'alzeh amar Rabbi Akiva kach. So lest you think that Bar Kokhba himself was some sort of miracle worker, some sort of tzaddik, what was the impressive thing that made Rabbi Akiva think that he was the Mashiach? The Romans would throw these giant catapult stones at the Jewish garrisons, and Bar Kokhba would nonchalantly catch it with his leg and throw it back and kill many Romans. That's actually amazing, right? Forget the catapult stones and the legs in particular. But it's amazing because of the kinds of things that's being singled out here. Right? What did Bar Kokhba do that was so impressive? Physical prowess. Right? He was an incredibly impressive warrior. Right? And there's actually a whole bunch of stories that we don't have time to do this morning that emphasize his physical prowess. What about his religiosity? Well, he's clearly a religious person. In historical terms, if you ask me, you know, what's Bar Kokhba's religious standing? He's not a rabbi. He's not as far as we can tell, not a particularly learned. I have no reason to think he is. I don't want to take it away from him if he was. But that's clearly not the picture we get. No one emphasizes that aspect of his personality, of his persona. But he's clearly a religious person, meaning he asked for lulav and etrog. One of his letters says, "Do this before Shabbat comes." In the same caves, in the Bar Kokhba caves. We have kelim, vessels that were captured from the Romans. A lot of these bowls and pans have pictures of gods on them, pagan images. They're all rubbed out. They're all defaced. Because that's what the Mishnah says, that if you have an image of an Avodah Zarah, you have to try to deface it. So he does that. His camp, is clearly religious people. These are Shomrei Torah Mitzvot. These are religious Jews. But that actually makes the religious question worse for Jews who live through the rebellion and see it crushed. Because if he is a religious person, if he does keep the Torah, believe in God, and so on and so forth, and he's impressive, and Rabbi Akiva was there, and Elazar HaKohen is there, then what went wrong? What else could you possibly have hoped for? Why didn't they succeed? So, I obviously don't have a full answer for that. But let's look at the end of this text on page 3. And this is at least one way in which Chazal seemed to be trying to grapple with this. V'kad ha'ava nefak l'krava, when he would go out to battle, hava amar, ribonei d'alma, latis or v'latich sof. Halo ata Elohim zenachtanu v'lotetze Elohim b'tzivotenu. Master of the world, don't help me and don't hinder me. Don't help me, don't hinder me. Now, don't hinder me, I get. But don't help me seems amazing, right? In other words, according to the Midrash, what Bar Kokhba's tefillah was, God, just stay out of it. don't show up on the battlefield. I've got this under control. I will take care of this. I obviously don't want you against me. Right? This is not an atheist creed. I don't want you against me. But I also don't need you on my side. Just stay away. And he quotes a pasuk that ostensibly says so. God, have you not cast us off? Do not go forth, O God, in our armies. Right? Hello. Ata Elohim zenachtanu v'lotete Elohim etzivotenu. Now, if you have a Tanakh, if you remember the Mizmor, that's not what the pasuk means in context. The pasuk says, it's a rhetorical question. God, haven't you cast us off? Do you not go forth anymore with our armies? On the contrary, please come back and help us. But taking the pasuk out of context, and we should say, for the record, that I have no real reason to think that Bar Kokhba himself said such a thing, but what the Midrash says Bar Kokhba said is, take the pasuk out of context and says, God, you've already cast us off. When did God cast us off?
The Churban.
The Churban, right? My grandparents' generation, my parents' generation. God, you didn't help us, right? We did this war already once, and you didn't help us at all. You didn't step in, you didn't come to our rescue, and that's why I have to fight now. So you know what, God? Hello, Ata Elohim Zenachtani, you've already forsaken us. Lo tetzei Elohim etzivotenu. So don't come in now. Just leave me alone. Now, as I said, Bar Kokhba himself is a religious person. This is actually a shocking thing to hear in anyone's mouth. I don't even know for a fact that Bar Kokhba is learned enough to take a pasuk in Tehillim out of context and do this really brilliant midrashic interpretation of it that turns it into a plea for God to stay out of the battle rather than what it is in context, for a plea for God to actually come into battle. I have no reason to think that Bar Kokhba himself said this. So to some extent, at least, this is Chazal trying to explain why Bar Kokhba is in the end not successful. In other words, to some extent, Chazal might be saying, well, Bar Kokhba, Shomer Torah Mitzvot, sure, Rabbi Kiva, sure, Elazar Kohen, sure, but deep piety, that's still missing. He's not really a pious person. There is another story that is actually a continuation of in the Yerushalmi and in Eicher Rabbah, and this we just don't have time to see inside, that Rabbi Elazar HaModa'i was in Beitar with Bar Kokhba, and that the only reason Bar Kokhba was still holding out there is because Rabbi Elazar HaModa'i was davening for his welfare every day. But then, due to a series of miscommunications, Bar Kokhba killed Rabbi Elazar HaModa'i for understandable but mistaken reasons. In other words, it's understandable why Bar Kokhba thought he should, but it was wrong. And once Rabbi Elazar HaModa'i is dead, Bar Kokhba falls, Beitar is destroyed, and the war comes to an end. Now, again, the key point here is that the Yerushalmi, the Midrash, says that the reason that Bar Kokhba was successful to begin with is because the rabbis were helping him. But Bar Kokhba didn't appreciate that. Bar Kokhba didn't really appreciate, according to the Chazal, didn't really appreciate just how much the religious nature of the war was the only thing propping him up. In other words, the only reason he was successful was that there were rabbis supporting him, that God was supporting him. And when he turned on them, when he turned on the rabbis, when he turned on God, at that point he fails. That's one way, I think, that Chazal could grapple with the catastrophe. They say, look, there's clearly something religiously missing here. Clearly, to some extent, he wasn't really as pious, he wasn't really as religiously devoted as he might have professed to be, as some people might have thought he was. That was lacking, and therefore, at the end of the day, he couldn't have been successful. But I want to end with one last observation, which is, I think, to me, the most poignant reaction that we might see in rabbinic literature. Rabbi Akiva is not just a rabbi, right? Rabbi Akiva is the central figure in the Tanaim, and those are the authors of the Mishnah, of Sefta, the Midrashei Halacha. He, his students, are the ones who give us, essentially, Chazal as we know it. Certainly the Mishnah, the Tosefta, the Midrashei Halacha, those are mostly his students. It's conventional to talk about the schools of Rabbi Akiva and the schools of Rabbi Ishmael. But Rabbi Ishmael, the school of Rabbi Ishmael is clearly more marginal. The Mishnah, for example, is said to be from the school of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is presumably an older person at the time of Bar Kokhba's rebellion. We don't have good data on his age. Chazal do say he lives to 120. 120 is obviously a typological number for how long great Jewish leaders should live. But if we assume he's an older person at Bar Kokhba's rebellion, 135, and he dies in or right after the rebellion. Remember, Rabbi Akiva's martyr story is one of the most famous stories of death in Chazal. So he would have been born, I don't know, let's say he was 80. I don't know, as a round number. That means he's born in 55. He's actually a teenager when the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed. He does remember that. His students don't remember the Beit HaMikdash, but are adults already in the time of Bar Kokhba's rebellion. His students are the ones who give us the Mishnah in its current form. What does it mean if you are Rabbi Akiva's student or Rabbi Akiva's grand student, and you have to think about Bar Kokhba's rebellion? Now, what are your options? What are your options? Either Rabbi Akiva was wrong, right? In which case, I have to grapple with the fact that the great rabbinic sage, who is literally the founding father of our circles, the great teacher, who is my teacher's teacher or my direct teacher, Shimon Bar Yochai, for example, talks about Akiva Rabbi, was wrong. He might have been a great teacher, but he was apparently a poor political analyst. As we know, that's actually not a simple thing for people to think. Right? People like to think that their great religious authorities are also great political analysts. Sometimes that's true. I assume that here it works. But often it's not. And people have a very hard time with that. And people have a very hard time separating religious authority from political insight. But that's one possibility. You have to grapple with the fact that Rabbi Akiva might be a great rabbi, but was a poor political analyst. And it's not a trivial mistake that his support for Bar Kokhba led to 500,000 Jewish deaths, the destruction of Yerushalayim, banishment of Jews from Yehuda, and so on. That's not a simple thing to wrap your head around. Or Rabbi Akiva was right, but then you have to somehow figure out what went wrong with the rebellion. In other words, maybe Rabbi Akiva was right that Bar Kokhba could have been Mashiach had things done better. So I think what we just saw is in that latter camp. Bar Kokhba maybe could have been Mashiach had Bar Kokhba been a better, more pious Jew. Maybe if he hadn't turned on Rabbi Elazar HaModa'i, maybe if he had davened to Hashem in a normal way instead of davening that Hashem would not come, maybe Rabbi Akiva could have been right. So maybe Rabbi Akiva was right, but Bar Kokhba failed us. But I think there's also, maybe the most powerful statement is that in all of the literature of the Tanaim, there's the Mishnah, the Tosefta, the Midrashei Halakha, all the literature of the Tanaim themselves, Bar Kokhba is never mentioned. None of the Tanaim in their own literature mention Bar Kokhba. Now this is living memory for them. This is someone that they lived through, either as children for the last of the Tanaim, or as adults for the greatest Tanaim. Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and so on, Rabbi Yehuda. These are all adults during Bar Kokhba's time. It's not conceivable that it made no impact on them, that they didn't notice that there was a tremendous catastrophe as they were young adults or even older adults. That's not possible. So I think the silence actually speaks to their inability to say anything about it. That they were essentially racked with religious anxiety about what to say. What do you say about Bar Kokhba without also condemning Rabbi Akiva? What do you say about the messianic potential in Bar Kokhba that's coherent? To some extent, I think this is comparable to the modern Orthodox response to the Holocaust, which is not the Haredi response, which is maybe surprising. But the modern Orthodox response to the Holocaust, overwhelming, and obviously I don't mean to say that everyone follows this line, but overwhelmingly is, there's nothing we can say. The catastrophe is too great to fathom. There's nothing intelligent. We can mourn, we can lament, but there's nothing theologically coherent that we can articulate about this. The catastrophe is just too great. I think it's entirely reasonable to compare the catastrophes. You could play with numbers, but I don't care so much about the demographics. In terms of the emotional trauma on the Jewish people, which has to be a result of a great catastrophe, it's entirely plausible to compare Bar Kokhba's rebellion to the Holocaust. There's all sorts of differences, but I think the silence of the Tanaim is a actually profound theological statement. That for a long time, for 3, 4, 5 generations, they simply didn't talk about it. Certainly when they're coming to write their literature, when they even Midrashei Halakha, which are not just Halakha, they reflect on all sorts of aspects of Jewish history, they never mention Bar Kokhba. not by name or not even implicitly. It's just not something to talk about because it's hard to say anything coherent. Anything I say, how do I say anything about Bar Kokhba without implying my criticism of Rabbi Akiva? Or how I defend Rabbi Akiva without implying that there's something else that might have gone right or wrong, getting into things that are just too complicated theologically, too complicated in the sense that I don't know if I can wrap my head around them. I don't know what exactly went wrong. And rather than offering some sort of blaming someone, right? Saying, oh, you know what? It was their fault. It was a Zionist fault. It was the assimilationist fault. Just saying, look, I don't know. I don't know. It was a great catastrophe. I can mourn for it. I can lament it. But that's all I can say. Other than that, theologically, I have to remain silent. That's obviously not something I can show you a text of. I could have put, I guess, a blank page in here to symbolically show what we have in all the literature of the Tanaim. But that silence is, I think, also a profound statement. So I'm going to have to wrap up. But the key point here is to appreciate that Bar Kokhba was lost to history to a large extent. Again, even his name was lost to history. Jews knew very, very little about him until basically the late 19th century, and then increasingly in the last half century or so. But what we did have was memories. But those memories are very conflicted. I included here, I'm not going to read it inside, but I included here on page 2, a machloka between the Rambam and the Ravid. The Rambam actually uses Bar Kokhba as evidence for what a Mashiach has to look like. I can learn from Bar Kokhba what the rules of a messianic figure have to be. The Ravid says, learn from Bar Kokhba. Bar Kokhba is just a false messiah. How can you learn anything from Bar Kokhba? But that conflict is actually deeply rooted in Chazal. Within Chazal, we see not the Tanaim, but the Amoraim, we see actually very different portraits. We see some portraits of him very sympathetic, but then explaining why something went wrong at the end. Our other portraits, like the short one we saw from the Gemara at the beginning, simply said, you know what, it's easier theologically to say Bar Kokhba is simply a false Mashiach. He came to the rabbis, he said, Anam Malka Mashiacha. So we got rid of him, and that goes back to the point that you made earlier. Theologically, it's obviously easier to say, we took care of the problem. The problem was that we had this guy who went around saying he was a Messiah, so we killed him. But that takes a lot of distance to say, because it's not factually true. The Jews were actually emotionally invested in Bar Kokhba, so only hundreds of years later could they say something like, you know what, Bar Kokhba was simply a mistake. That's something that no Jew in Eretz Israel in the times of the Tanaim or even the early Amoraim could have easily said because the trauma was too raw. Later on, some Jews at least, in the Gemara, made their peace with Bar Kokhba by simply turning on him and saying, you know what, without any support, he came to the rabbis claiming to be Mashiach, and we got rid of that problem. The Bavli also says that Jesus came to the rabbis and claimed to be a messianic figure, and so the rabbis killed him as well. As it turns out, that was a fatefully bad claim to make for the Jews. But that is one way that the Gemara deals with problematic figures. One way is to say, we didn't have to, this is not complicated, right? There was a figure who was bad, problematic, so we are the front lines. We stepped up and we got rid of him. Historically speaking, that's not accurate. Thankfully, in the case of Jesus, it's not accurate. And in the case of Bar Kokhba, it doesn't seem to be accurate either. But it does speak to the attempts to grapple with someone who I think it's hard for us to appreciate, but it was so inspiring to his contemporaries for a brief period of time, and so then so catastrophically problematic afterwards, that he left a tremendous imprint on Jewish memory, and it's taken us a long time to extract some history from all out of all that memory. So I'm going to leave it with that. I'm happy to hear your thoughts and comments. Please.
I just wanted to
I personally don't have a lot of expertise in determining messianic figures. The Rambam does not think that the Mashiach has to do anything supernatural. And that's actually the text that you have on page 2. The Rambam says, someone who's a Mashiach, who there's reason to think is Mashiach, needs to have no supernatural abilities, just has to be on, I suppose, her or his way to redeeming the world, to bringing a redeemed world to our society. The Rambam thinks, in general, that the Messianic age is not going to be at all different qualitatively from our world, other than there will be no Shibun Malchiyot, there will be no political oppression, particularly for the Jews, but it sounds like a more general claim as well. What'd you say?
The lion, the sheep will sleep in the same cage.
Well, that is actually the same parak in Yeshayahu, that is supernatural. So the Rambam denies any of that from the Messianic age, and unless he takes that as a metaphor for nations, yes, which is what the Radak said. But the Ravid, who often argues with the Rambam, Ravid says, what do you mean no supernatural abilities? I have this Gemara in Sanhedrin that says that a Mashiach has to be able to judge through smelling. So that proves that there has to be some sort of miracle ability for the Mashiach. Without some sort of miraculous ability, no one can really be a messianic figure. So I have no way of getting involved in this debate. All I'll say is that it's a debate whether there's any sort of supernatural ability that the Mashiach needs to have, or if it's just a question of results on the ground. If there's peace in the world that the Mashiach has brought, then that person is Mashiach. There's a joke that my senior colleague, Dr. David Berger, likes to tell. For those of you who know something about his recent work, you know why he likes to tell it. But that there is a rabbi, is told about a bunch of different rabbis, but a rabbi on a train in Russia in the late 19th century, one of these trains across the Palace Settlement, and the car is relatively empty. So there's one Jewish businessman on the car, and this Jew is a pious but relatively uneducated Jew. He's sitting there, and at some station, two missionaries get on the train, and they start accosting this pious but uneducated Jew. And they say, the Jews are downtrodden because they rejected Jesus, and so on and so forth. And the guy says, look, I'm not a theologian. I don't have any insight here. I trust the rabbis of the Talmud. The rabbis of the Talmud, they lived after Jesus. They rejected Jesus, and I trust their judgment as to the claim that Jesus was not the Messiah, and that's all I put my faith in them. And they said, you put your faith in them? They're bad at deciding who the Mashiach is. You know your great teacher, Rabbi Akiva, he thought Bar Kokhba was the Mashiach. Look what happened with that. The guy's like, I don't know, that's actually not a bad point. So the rabbi comes over and says, wait, hold on. Gentlemen, let me ask you a question. How do you know that Bar Kokhba was not the Mashiach? What do you mean Bar Kokhba was not? How can you even ask such a question? He died. And the rabbi says, all right, that's all I have to say.
We'll take one more question, and then we're going to bench. And if Dr. Kohler has the time, but people can ask
certainly
questions after benching.
I don't know. Maybe, yeah.
Oh.
No, nothing. Can we have one more question?
Sure. Just a point, the second point that we were looking at with the picture of the Beit HaMikdash in the front.
Yeah.
Earlier we were discussing that Bar Kokhba was not around during the time of the Beit HaMikdash.
Right.
How would he be able to have that depiction or an image of it in order for it?
I have no reason to think that he was the artist behind this coin. Meaning, presumably, he outsources the coin making. And we can guess, but there's no certainty, that whoever is imprinting a schematic picture of the Beit HaMikdash either knows or asks someone, well, what did the facade actually look like? But it's, you're obviously right that this is not eyewitness testimony. We have Josephus, who was an eyewitness. He happens not to say anything about the number of columns in the front of the Beit HaMikdash. But there's a husband and wife team, the Rittmeyers, Lean and Kathleen Rittmeyer, first names, right? And they actually, if you go to their website, they spend a lot of time trying to reconstruct what Yerushalayim looked like in Bayit Sheni times. So they do take this coin as their evidence for the front of the Beit HaMikdash. But you're certainly right that that's not impeccably beyond reproach historically. It's just the best we can do. A great point. All right. So.
Thank you very much. Next week, Rabbi Shiffman will be back to a regular scheduled session. Once again, thank you so very much, Jake and Karen Abelevitz, for giving us this and all the many Torah opportunities. We'll conclude now with benching. Time.